This chapter is on samples and correlations, sort of the practical stuff from probability. It begins with a discussion of descriptive statistics. Now, two things you need to get straight are sample and population. The sample is a group of things that we've actually observed. So, for example, I can talk about the OBU students that I've had in class, or maybe the particular kind of Wendy's restaurants, the particular Wendy's restaurants where I've eaten. Or I went to graduate school with some people from Greece, so the sample could be people that I know from Greece. Or in a factory, you can have the items that are made in that factory that were actually checked by the quality control people. Now, the population is the bigger group that I'm interested in. I want to make some generalizations about all OBU students, or all Wendy's restaurants, or I want to know what all the people in Greece are like, or the quality control is not really worried about just those tires. They want to have some knowledge about all the tires that are made at that factory. Variables are properties or attributes of a thing that come in degrees. So with people, we can talk about their age. That comes in degrees from 0 to somewhere around 100, or their weight, or their income. Or for students, you can talk about the GPA, which has some range to it, anywhere from a 4.0 to, I guess you could have a 0.0, although they won't let you stay in college for very long. And these variables have a distribution of values. Okay, dichotomous variables only have two values. It's a binary thing. It's just a one or a zero. Male, female. Employed, unemployed. Passed or failed. So when we're talking about this, the sample, some variable, you assign that some numerical value, and we'll call that a statistic. So a statistic would be the average GPA of the sampled OBU students. In the population, it's a parameter. So the parameter would be the average GPA of all OBU students. Now, three different kinds of measures of central tendency. So, all right, we're looking for something in the middle, roughly. Okay, three different ways to talk about that. One is the mean. The mean is the mathematical average. And to find the mean, you add all the numbers together and divide by the number of cases. Okay, so add all the values and then divide by the number of those different values. The median is the one that's in the middle. Okay, so that half are over that value and half are under that value. So in that list there, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 3 is right in the middle, and it's the median. The mode is the value that occurs most often. So in the series 1, 2, 3, 2, 4, we have two twos. It occurs more often than any other, so it's the mode. Okay, now average is not enough because we can have two series that have the same average, but they differ in a significant way. So sometimes we want to talk about the dispersal, and the dispersal is how spread out these values are. For instance, 7, 8, 8, 9 and 1, 3, 11, 17 have the same mean, but there's only a difference of 2 between the least and the greatest in the first series, or in the first set of values. In the second set, there's a difference of 16 between the least and the greatest. Now, why is that important? Well, it's pretty easy to figure out why it's important when you think about average temperature. Oklahoma City and Los Angeles, California have very close to the same average annual temperature. Of course, I woke up this morning and the wind chill in Norman, Oklahoma was 13 degrees above zero, and That tells me that there's just looking at average annual temperatures not enough. It's important to know how spread out those temperatures are over the year. Okay, how do we measure dispersal? Range is the distance between the least and the greatest. Percentile rank. Sometimes when you take a standardized test, they'll give you percentile rank. That's the percent of values that fall below whatever the given value is there. So if you're in the 99th percentile, you know that 99% of the people scored less than you did. In statistics, they talk a lot about standard deviation. So, one reason that's important, at least for us to understand, is because we can use at least an estimate of standard deviation to figure what the margin of error is in a particular study. So you need to know how to do this. If n equals the sample size, one standard deviation is equal to 1 divided by 2 times the square root of n. So if the sample size is 100, then the margin of error is not the margin of error, but one standard deviation is equal to 1 over 2 times square root of 100, which is 2 times 10, which is 20. So one standard deviation, 1 over 20. Okay, inferential statistics is when you make an inference from a sample to a population. So we look at some features of the sample, and then we infer that the population also has those characteristics to the same degree, roughly to the same degree as the sample. Our premises in these arguments, in these inferences, are claims about the sample. The conclusion is a claim about the population. These are invalid arguments. Okay? They're not deductively valid because they make an inductive leap. So we have this information about the sample, and we conclude something about the population. But if we do them right, they can be very inductively strong. So an inference from the sample to population, a couple of things you need to know. One's a margin of error. The margin of error is a range surrounding the value in the sample. Okay. And we're willing to say that the answer for the population is somewhere within that range. Okay, the confidence level is how confident you can be that the value in the population is within the margin of error of the value in the sample. Now, one question is how are the margin of error and confidence level correlated? So if I make the margin of error bigger, if I make the interval around the answer that I get for the sample larger, I ought to be, the greater that interval becomes, the more confident I can be that the real answer for the population is somewhere in that range. If I shrink the range, I make it smaller and smaller, the less confident I can be that the right answer is somewhere in that range. Okay, so a confidence level is at some percentage. The 95% confidence level, if a study's at the 95% confidence level, that means that I can be 95% sure that the value in the population is within the margin of error of the value of the sample. Okay, now at the 95% confidence level, the margin of error equals plus or minus 2 standard deviations. And the 95% confidence level is the most common confidence level that's used in statistics because that gets us a sort of the magic number of being pretty confident about our answer and also having a fairly narrow range there. So we can be pretty sure what the value is, and we can be pretty sure it's one of a pretty small set. Okay. So remember, if we back up a little bit, the one standard deviation equals 1 over 2 times the square root of the sample size. Since our margin of error is plus or minus 2 standard deviations, our margin of error at the 95% confidence level, and we're always going to assume the 95% confidence level, the margin of error will be 1 over the square root of the sample size, just 1 over the square root of the sample size. Okay, let me back up a little bit. That means the margin of error, if you have a sample of 100, the margin of error is plus or minus 10%. If you have a sample size of 400, the margin of error is 1 over the square root of 400, which is 1 over the square root of 20, which is plus or minus 5%. So burn that into your mind. Sample size of 100, plus or minus 10. Sample size of 400, plus or minus 5. Here's an example. A study looked at 8 different childhood traumas. They ranged from psychological abuse, something bad happened when you were a kid. Sampled 9,215 adult patients. And it turned out that people who had experienced 5 or more of these traumas were 5.4 times more likely to start smoking by the age of 14 than people who had experienced no trauma. Okay, here are the questions to ask when you evaluate a study like this. What's the population? Well, they don't really say in that population what the population is in the information that I've given you. So you think, what's the population likely to be? The population is likely to be U.S. adults, for instance. Okay, what are the conclusions? The study concludes that these early traumas increase the likelihood of smoking. What's the base rate? Well, what does base rate mean? Base rate is just what's the prevalence in the overall population of whatever it is that we're talking about. So how many people, what's the percentage of people who smoke among U.S. adults in America? Well, the study doesn't report what the base rate is. Now, why would it matter what the base rate is? Why would it be important to know what the base rate is? One reason it would be important to know is because we really need to know if this is going to be risky behavior or is this something that we need to be worried about. It may turn out, for instance, and this will come up later in another lecture, it may turn out that if you drink unfiltered water, for instance. Maybe a study will show if you drink unfiltered water, then the probability of your developing a particular brain cancer goes up 10 times. Well, is that something you should be worried about? Maybe they can eliminate that or cut it in half by installing a really expensive water filter on your water system in your house. Going to cost you $10,000 to cut this chance of getting this cancer back by 50%, 60, 70, 80, 90, whatever. Maybe it's something you should spend the $10,000 to avoid having this brain cancer. Well, you find out, once you look at the base rate, you find out that only this type of cancer is so rare that only one in every 100 million people get it. Okay, so it may be that if you drink that unfiltered water, your chances of getting it will go from one in roughly a billion to 10 in a billion. Okay, now is that something you really need to be worried about? Probably not. Okay, so the base rate's important. Well, our inductive inference from sample to population is going to be pretty strong, provided we've got a good sample. So what kind of features does a good sample have? First thing is a good sample has to be large enough. Second is a good sample needs to be one that's not biased. Ideally, good samples are representative. A representative sample is one in which Every property that occurs in the population occurs in the sample, and it occurs with exactly the same degree as it does in the population. So a representative sample would be like a smaller mirror image of the population. So if the population was half male, half female, ideally the sample would be half male, half female. If the population was 60% Caucasian, then 30% African American, 10% Hispanic, then the sample ideally would be 60% Caucasian, 30% African American, 10% Hispanic, so on. So everything that the population has, the sample would have it to the same degree. Now, we can't guarantee that a sample is going to be representative. And if you think about why that's the case, it ought to be pretty easy to figure out. We don't know what characteristics the population has, and we don't know them to what degree the population has those characteristics. If we already knew every characteristic that the population had and to what degree it had that characteristic, we wouldn't need to be taking a sample. We're taking the sample because we want to figure out these facts about the population. So we can't guarantee that our sample is going to be representative, but there are certain kinds of samples that are more likely to be representative, and those are random samples. A sample is random if everyone in the population has an equal chance of being sampled. Okay, everybody in the population has an equal chance of being included in the sample. Sometimes this is hard to get, mainly because we can make these mistakes, and these mistakes look fairly innocent, but making these mistakes will ensure that certain people aren't going to be included in our sample. So maybe random phone calls, for instance. Okay, we select these phone numbers out of the phone listings very randomly. We call these people. We're not screening them beforehand. It's just a pure random selection. But it's a pure random selection of only those people who have phones. So you've already thrown out anybody who doesn't own a phone, right? You've thrown out anybody who has a phone, but they only use cell phone, and they don't have a phone in their house that's connected to the telephone system where it will end up being in the phone book. So we've already ensured that certain members of the population won't be members of the sample. So it's hard to do, but it's important to do, at least the best that we can. Okay, even if we do things right and we get an unbiased sample, it can not well. We do our best to get a particular sample. We're trying the best that we can, and we end up getting false conclusions. So, for example, let's say we draw many different samples of 500 U.S. voters each. Then we ask these people who they support for president. Well, we're going to get some variation in the samples, right? Because it's just a matter of luck. It's just pure chance who we draw if it's a random sample. So it's possible that we take a sample of 500 voters and we happen to get 500 very committed Republicans. It's also possible that purely by chance we get 500 very committed Democrats and we get two different answers. So there's going to be some variation. This is called sampling variability or sampling error. It's not really an error, it's just called sampling error. Okay, bad samples. We get bad inferences when we use bad samples. Two problems. One problem is that we didn't use a big enough sample. Second problem is that our sample was biased. So we're very often insensitive to the need for a large enough sample or the need for an unbiased sample. For instance, about 50 babies are born a day in a large hospital, 15 a day in a smaller hospital. Which hospital is more likely to have more days per year when over 65% of the births are boys? Well, how many, what's the percentage that you would expect to be boys? Well, we'd expect roughly 50%. So that's the value that we expect to see in the population. You can look at this hospital as a sample. Okay. So which sample is more likely to be farther away from the value in the population? The big sample or the small sample? Well, the big sample, we expect if the larger the sample gets, the closer we expect it to be to the value in the population. So it's going to be the small sample that is more likely to be way over or way below. So the small hospital is more likely to have more days per year when they have over 65% of boys born. Okay, so that's a problem with sample size. Let's look at this. You can do a search on Google for cats falling in New York City and find all kinds of newspaper stories about this. So in New York City, we get all these cats that fall from open windows in high-rise apartments. The New York Times reported that 129 fallen cats were brought in for treatment. Of those 129, this is what happened to them. 14 were put to sleep. Put to sleep is a, if you remember back a few lectures, put to sleep is a euphemism. So they're put to sleep by their owners, mainly because the treatment was too costly. That leaves 115 cats, and out of those 115 cats, 8 of them died. Okay, well, here's what's interesting. Only one of the 22 cats that fell from 7 stories died. Okay, there was only one fracture among the 13 cats that fell over 9 stories. So we back up a little bit. 8 cats died. Only one of the 22 cats that fell from above 7 stories died, which means that the 7 cats that died were cats that fell from less than 7 stories, 7 stories or less. So it looks like the higher the cat falls, the less likely it is to die. The higher the cat falls, the less likely it is to have any broken bones. So what would account for the results that we get here? Before I look at this other study, what do you think would account for it? It'd be my guess that what we have is a biased sample. So what might happen is that a bunch of these cats that fall from over 7 stories die, but since they're dead, the owners don't bother taking them to the vet. So the ones that get taken into the vet, that is what provides the sample, and the sample's highly biased. So the dead cats are much less likely to get included in the sample. Okay, another example. There was a committee that decided to, they were assigned to set guidelines for psychotherapists, and the question was, should the therapist report a client who has admitted to sexually abusing children? Now, not sexually abusing children now, but having sexually abused children in the past, not since then, but in the distant past. Okay, based on their own experience with child abusers, the therapist said it should be reported because, quote, "the one sure thing about child abusers is that they never stop without professional help." Well, this might very well be true, but it's a biased sample because the therapists are appealing to child abusers that they've treated, and the only ones that stopped of the ones they treated were the ones that stopped with professional help. So they're only talking, their sample only includes people who had professional help. Okay, correlation. Correlation is a measure of the degree to which two things are related. If there's a positive correlation, higher values of one variable tend to go with higher values of the other variable. So height and weight. People who are taller tend to weigh more. Okay. The longer people tend to stay in school, get the higher the income they end up having. So people who drop out at sixth grade tend to have lower incomes. People who finish high school have higher incomes. People who get a college degree have even higher incomes, so on like that. Not always, but there's a correlation. Negative correlation, high value in one variable tend to go with lower values of the other. For instance, years in school, years spent in prison. Okay, what do these correlations mean? Well, an example is smoking and heart attacks. There's a positive correlation between smoking and heart attacks. Now, this doesn't mean that a smoker is highly likely to have a heart attack. So, it may be the case that smokers are still highly unlikely to have heart attacks. Not a whole lot of people have heart attacks. It doesn't even mean that you are a smoker is more likely to have a heart attack than not have a heart attack. Okay. All it means is that there are more heart attacks among smokers than there are among non-smokers. So the probability of having a heart attack, given that you have a, that you're a smoker, is greater than the probability of having a heart attack, given that you're a non-smoker. Okay, we use these correlations to make predictions. So the higher the correlation, the better the prediction. If there's a complete positive correlation, then the correlation is 1. It's equal to 1. A complete positive correlation, or a correlation of 1, is one in which a higher, if a one variable goes high, goes up, the other variable has to go up also. One goes up, the other will go up. Yeah, always go up. It's never a case where it goes down. If it's impossible for one to go up without the other going up. Example is height in inches, height in feet. If your height in inches goes up, your height in feet will go up. Complete negative correlation is the reverse. So if one goes up, the other must go down. If there's no correlation, then the two values are independent. So that's a correlation of 0. Okay, height in inches, height in feet, that's kind of a trivial correlation, right? It's just both are a measure of some length. So of course, as length goes up, length will go up. So it's a fairly trivial correlation. In fact, interesting perfect correlations are really rare. The interesting correlations are somewhere in between 1 minus 1. Correlation and probability. Okay, again, positive correlation between smoking and heart attacks. That means the probability of H given S is greater than the probability of H. So, and probability of H given S greater than the probability of H given not S. If one of those holds, the other will too. So negative correlation between exercising and heart attacks. So the probability of H, probability of having a heart attack given that you exercise, is less than the probability of having a heart attack given that you don't exercise. Probability of having a heart attack given exercise is less than the probability of just having a heart attack. Again, both of those will hold if either one does. Okay, now correlation is symmetrical. It's a two-way street. If A is positively correlated with B, B will be positively correlated with A. That means if the probability of A given B is greater than the probability of A, then the probability of B given A, it will be greater than the probability of B. You can prove that if you like, given the rules of probability and the definition of conditional probability. Okay, same thing holds for negative correlations and for non-correlations. Okay. Both symmetrical. If A and B are have a correlation of 0, then B and A will have a correlation of 0. If A and B are independent, of course B and A are independent. So what that means is that if A is changing won't affect B, of course B is changing won't affect A. Okay, correlation is comparative. If we want to know if smoking is correlated with heart attacks, we can't just look at the probability of being a smoker given that you had a heart attack. So what would that mean? That means we look at all these people that have heart attacks and we see what's the percentage of people who smoke. We have to compare the percentage of smokers among heart attack victims with the percentage of smokers among non-heart attack victims. Okay, and we can look at this with a diagram. Here's a positive correlation. Stronger positive correlation. Notice in the first we have 20 heart attacks, 30 smokers. So actually, I got that labeled backwards. So I want to reverse those two. Oh, no, those are non-smokers, smokers. So we're looking at, no, that looks right. The graph is showing for people who had heart attacks, we had among smokers, we have 30% heart attacks. Among non-smokers, we had 20% heart attacks. Okay. So almost a third of the smokers had heart attacks. A fifth of the non-smokers had heart attacks. Okay, now a stronger correlation. We have half of the smokers having heart attacks, and still a fifth of the non-smokers having heart attacks. Okay, independence is when the two are at the same height. So 30% smokers heart attacks, 30% non-smokers have heart attacks. So it looks like smoking doesn't really have anything to do with it. Okay, the difference between correlation and causation. Correlations in these studies suggest that there's some causation. If these two things go together, we suspect that there's some causal link that makes them go together. But correlation is not the same thing as causation. Importantly, it's not two-way. It's not symmetrical. If A is correlated with B, we know that B will be correlated with A. But if A causes B, we generally don't think that B causes A. So if a driver is driving down the road, makes an obscene gesture at another driver, that second driver is offended. So there's a correlation between being offended and obscene gestures, right? And so if the obscene gesture is correlated with the offense, then being offended is correlated with obscene gestures. On the other hand, if the obscene gesture caused the person to be offended, that makes sense. It doesn't make any sense to say that the person being offended caused the obscene gesture. Why is that important? Well, if we've got a common cause, two effects of some common cause are correlated together. Whenever one occurs, the other will occur too. So, but they don't cause each other. So if you have allergies, let's say pollen is high, your eyes itch and water, and you sneeze, we have joint effects of a common cause. It's the allergy that's causing both the eyes watering and the sneezing. It doesn't make any sense to say that your eyes water, and that's what causes you to sneeze. But it can be really, that's easy to figure out, but it can be hard to figure out in some complex social situations. Like a drop in crime. Drop in crime is correlated with all kinds of different things. See if we have... No, I didn't list those. There are people who think that the drop in crime may be correlated with increased numbers of police on the streets. Could be correlated with aging population. Right? It's correlated with maybe... higher percentage of people going to college. It's correlated with what other things? Correlated with higher income levels. A recent book that points out that recent drop in crime is correlated with a legalized abortion, even. So all these different factors that are correlated with drops in crime, it's really hard to figure out just what's playing a causal role. Okay. Illusory correlation is when we think there's a correlation, but there's really not one. Okay, so we attribute a correlation, and we attribute a correlation, we tend to attribute some sort of false cause. An example of an illusory correlation is the halo effect. Remember, when we think that a person, we tend to think that people who have one good quality also have other good qualities. So people who are good looking are also, we think being good looking is correlated with being smart. So we listen to people who might be, we might consider good looking. We also consider them smart. But it's just an illusory correlation. They're problematic because we tend to find these correlations when they don't exist, and then we use them to make predictions and explanations. Then these predictions and explanations turn out to be false. And that's the end of the lecture on samples.